There continues to be mixed news out of Somalia. Good news, the first peaceful transition from one government to the next after an imperfect election, but an election nonetheless. There are still car bombs going off in Mogadishu. In fact, there was one this week that killed at least 10. Not sure if you heard about that one, but they are less frequent than 10 years ago. And now there is the drought and famine is looming, and there is evidence that the droughts are becoming more frequent under the influence of climate change. People already dying of starvation. The UN heading to Somalia with aid, and Australia has also committed some funds to assist in the management of the famine. But is it time to rethink the management of drought in this increasingly dry part of Africa? Our next guest thinks so. Now, he's been on the program before, a very, very long time ago, when he still lived in Melbourne. Mohamed Ibrahim was one of the first Somali refugees to come here back in the 1980s. And recently, he spent a lot of time back in Somalia, mostly supporting the establishment of the telecommunications industry. And he's moved back to Mogadishu now. He was the Minister for Post and Telecommunications for a while, but is now working in the private sector. Mohamed Ibrahim joins us on the line from Dubai, where he's attending a conference. After a long absence, welcome back.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Mohamed, can you fill us in on the current state of play in Somalia? You've just elected a shiny, bright new president.
That's correct. His Excellency Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo is the best so far. And we're very happy. We came a long way and we're excited about this.
He's educated, I understand, in the US.
That's correct. And he worked there. He's also an American citizen, but he's back here and helping the country. He was previous prime minister for a short time. And now he's popularly elected through the 4.5 system. And we're excited about that.
How did the elections go? I know there were hopes for a one-person, one-vote election, but that wasn't quite possible.
We tried. We tried very hard, but I don't want to jump into a conclusion, but the UN and others could have done more. But nevertheless, 2020, we are committed. It will be one person, one vote, and that's where we are going. This time, it was much better. The one before this, there were only a handful of people appointing others. This time there were 10,400 plus people electing the current government. So we came a long way. In our own way, it's one step forward towards democracy.
And of course, the splendid achievement of a peaceful transition.
Correct. And historically, I would like to remind your listeners, 1960 to 64, Somalia was the first African country where there was an election and power was transferred peacefully. But since then, we went backwards. That's human nature, I guess. But we're back. That's the message. We are back and we are facing the international community seriously.
And congratulations, too, on the fact that 25% of the members of parliament are women.
Correct. That's true, too. So there are a lot of positive stuff. With all the, I would call the fake news you hear about Somalia, we are actually doing well, but of course there are other challenges, we can talk about that, but in terms of rebuilding our institutions and getting the government back on track and working, we came a long way. Just very quickly, I want to mention, in fact, I myself worked on a project called Somali School of Government. Anyone can look at it, it's online, ssog.edu.so, where we are trying to train anyone who's interested in Somali politics on the basic stuff of democracy. Liberal democracy, what does it mean to be a parliamentarian? What does it mean to be a citizen? All those basic things we take for granted in other parts of the world. We have now a website. We are trying to educate our people.
What about security? I mentioned the car bomb in Mogadishu this week, not far from the presidential palace, killing at least 10. But as I know you pointed out in elsewhere, at least that's better than 30 car bombs a day.
That's the perspective we have to look at. Over my last 10 years of involvement in my country, we always forget, but we really came a long way. Yes, the timing, it's never good, even if you lose one person. And this particular one, that's how Shabab likes to salute us and send us a message. As the Prime Minister was appointing and talking about the new cabinet, exactly at the same time, it just happened a few hundred meters away from the same place. But to be honest with you, we don't get sad about this. We are moving forward. The trend is up. The Shabab gigs will continue and they will be with us for a long time, but much, much diminished. And we're not worried about them anymore.
Are you disappointed that this event perhaps got 1% of the column inches that the London bomb got?
That's the world we live in, and you're right. And you think what goes on in Mogadishu is no longer news at all. And that's really the injustice in many ways. But we don't give up. We will tell people, we'll write, we will talk about it, we'll just keep pushing. But yes, it's very unfair. And even the one before this, a lot more people were killed. It didn't make a mention anywhere. I Googled everywhere. We won't be anywhere in the news. But we will just take that as part of the challenges we have to resolve. We just have to keep moving forward.
I understand that the current president is not seen as sufficiently religious by some of his critics.
That is a good observation, but that whole area, really, we want to belittle this whole idea about religiosity and the Shababs or whatever. We just want to really belittle that. Why? Because there are more important issues ahead of us. And we are talking to everyone, really, whether they're the religious groups or even the Shababs and all those people. We want to get inclusive community where everyone will have a say. And we will just explain. Yes, we are all Muslims. We have differences. But the bigger picture is more important. And it doesn't make sense to kill your own fellow Muslim. And the trend is changing. A lot of people are now realizing, really, we just have to move on.
I've got to ask you this. What percentage of Somalis would have a mobile phone?
Quite a large number. I cannot tell you the exact number, but I can say we are between 3.5 to 4 million. Let's put it this way. Proportionally, we are probably one of the leading in Africa. And it's one of those success stories that people don't know. But we don't use mobiles just for talking. In fact, we use the data side as well. In other words, for other applications, apps. And more importantly, the most important part, it's our bank. It's our financial sector. We are almost cashless society. From Melbourne, I was able to send money, and I don't know whether you saw once there was a letter to the editor in The Age when our Reserve Bank in Australia was saying this would be a new idea using mobile phones. I mentioned that 4 or 5 years ago in Mogadishu, we were buying and selling stuff using our mobile phones. So we don't only use mobile phones for talking, but we actually use it for business.
I have another reason for raising this issue, and that is that paradoxically, You tell us that there's not one security camera in Mogadishu.
Yes. In fact, a week ago I was in California, the University of California, Berkeley, and I couldn't resist as I was walking in that beautiful university campus to see all this technology, you know, this cameras, security. In fact, there's hardly anything to worry about in that environment, but nevertheless, there was equipment. And I wrote back to folks back home and to other authorities and UN people and so on, saying, tell me why there are hundreds of these cameras in this campus and not one single security camera in the whole country.
I'm not suggesting for a minute, nor would you, that that such cameras will be the solution to the security crisis. Where does the solution lie? Is it just a matter of more money for the Somali armed forces?
I think the first step, and I keep recommending this all the time, is to give the Somalis a chance, to give the government, the ministers, the president, the individual Somali a chance to speak up and contribute and listen to, whether it's the UN people or the Amazon or the AU or anyone who thinks can solve Somalia's problem, to give the Somalis a chance and to listen to them. They have something to say, something to contribute. They know what the problem is. But unfortunately, it's always top-down. And the top-down solution so far is more boots on the ground. Well, we had more boots on the ground since the last 20 years, 25 years. It didn't solve the problem. So this is, I think, the first step. We have a saying in Somalia where about a rabbit who was shivering, and he was asked why he was shivering since the rain has stopped. And the rabbit says, "It's not about this rain, but it's the one that's coming I'm shivering about." Now, this is probably the smallest wisdom people can listen to say, look, why don't we give the Somalis a chance and let's see if they can solve their problems and use their solutions.
So that's there was in the really bad days a quite a large brain drain of the best and the brightest leaving Somalia. There's quite a few people have gone back, and I understand that as a consequence, business is booming.
Correct. In fact, the terminology I use is now brain circulation. And the idea is we're not moving out. In other words, it's not only Somalis going overseas and making business or studying or working overseas. It's now circulating. There are a lot of Somalis in the diaspora from the States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Europe, everywhere, coming back and contributing. And then again, going back perhaps and doing something else. So now we have this brain circulation where we're getting ideas from everywhere and trying to implement them in Somalia. I'll just mention quick solutions that are now happening. For example, there is a website called abaraha.org. This is based on open source software, which Somalis developed, where now people can help those who are suffering the drought through those solutions. I mentioned the mobile money. There are many, many others I can mention. So hence, yes, the old terminology of brain drain is no longer applicable in Somalia. We have brain circulation.
I'm talking to Mohamed Ibrahim, who was at one point the Minister for Telecommunications. Now, you're describing what amounts to a much more energetic flow of people in and out of the country. But I'm wondering, as a Somali-born man who travels a lot, currently in Dubai, have you been affected by the new restrictions announced by the US, even with your Australian passport?
Yep, that comes with a job. I was in the States last week. A lot of my friends were saying I must be crazy traveling to the States in these interesting times. But I did. I landed in San Francisco, and of course I have to go the normal, usual, what I call the predictable random checks. But this time I was lucky. In fact, it wasn't that bad. But the one before this, I spent 4 hours just basically being asked questions that were, I would call, nonsense. But I have to go through it because that's the world we live in. So to overcome this, I think we are nomads, and we learn. I actually never have a visa. I actually asked the Australian embassy in Australia to give me a visa. So I have a 5-year visa, but even that is not helping, because there's so many rules. The rules change all the time. And flying from Mogadishu via Dubai to San Francisco, going to a cybersecurity conference, there's so many questions you can expect to be asked. But I survived, and we still have to respect the rule of law. So the system somehow worked.
Mohamed, now, of course, we have to add in the new ban on carrying anything more consequential than a phone. Is this going to make your life even more complex?
Yes. In fact, I'm changing now all my travel arrangements, and I have to fly via Australia. This is just so ridiculous and so crazy and so illogical. It just doesn't make sense. But then, as I said, we're living in interesting times. What is the difference between cargo hold and a cabin? If I have my laptop in a bag in the cargo, it's just as dangerous if someone is trying to do something, whether it is in a cargo or whether it is in a cabin. But who am I to ask this? There are more wise people who are coming up with all this crazy stuff.
Let's now go to the subject of the drought. The biggest challenge for the new government will be the looming drought and, of course, a consequential famine. But it's far from the first time your country has faced a drought, isn't it?
No, it's not the first time. In fact, I did a bit of a research here, but there's from 1900 to 2013, there were 642, droughts globally, say over 113 years. 45% or 291 of those droughts affecting 362 million happened in Africa. So that's something like 2.5 a year. In other words, every year there was a drought somewhere in Africa. And 847,000 died over that time. So nothing new about drought. Now, the reason I wrote about this and the reason I'm challenging a lot of people who are working in this environment is, how can drought be a breaking news? It just doesn't make sense. Drought was with us, it's with us now, it will be with us in the future. It's what do we do about it?
Well, as you know, in this country, we live with it as a constant factor. We're just having them more frequently. If we look back to the 72 famine in Somalia, the government forced people to move from the areas of drought. You don't think that the population has to move away in the same, to the same extent?
In fact, I was in a primary school when that happened. You're right. And a lot of people were moved from one part of Somalia to another part of Somalia. Now, looking back, research shows probably that was the best we did, or the military government did then. Why? Because a lot more people survived, and they learned different skills. They became farmers, and they went to the sea. We have the longest coastline. They started fishing and so on. And these are the challenges I'm bursting to the UN and all the other global institutions, saying, look, why don't we look for creative solutions? Why do we have to keep repeating the same thing and then expect different outcome? Wasn't that the definition of insanity? So what I'm really recommending is that we can study that 72-75 drought alone. 20,000 people died in Somalia, 200,000 died in Ethiopia next door. Why? Because probably they followed a different strategy. I'm not saying that's what we should do, but there's so many other possibilities that nobody's looking at. We're only waiting for the UN and its definitions that 20% of the households must be affected, 30% must be malnourished, 2 people must die, but 10,000? Who says this? In what book are this written?
Over the years, we've often told the stories about how good intentions at the time of drought lead to unexpected and really quite serious problems. And one of them is when aid floods in, which has the effect of discouraging farmers.
Correct. Yeah, I think that's what I'm getting at. It's the timing. Now everyone is jumping up and down. The UN is saying, oh, we need 4.4 million, but we're only getting 22 million or something. Well, but now it's too late. People are already dying. And the thing that upsets me is things like drought. You don't have to even be a scientist. If it doesn't rain, you know there will be no crops. If there are no crops and people live on subsistence farming, what happens? Then they have nothing to eat. Then the UN from New York or somewhere or Nairobi will say, oh, now we have the definition of famine, so let's quickly raise funding. But it's already too late.
You make the point that three measures must be met by the UN to determine a famine, and then it's too late and people are already dying.
It's almost obscene. If I was a minister or manager or running a shop, even let's use that crazy analogy of fish and chips in Queensland. No, I'm just joking. If I do something like this, my boss will say, look, your definitions are wrong. It doesn't make sense. In this case, it's a national, global scale. We're talking about human beings. And someone had the guts to say, 2 people must die, but 10,000 people, then we will say, oh, now we have a famine. Then what do you do? Oh, and then we'll raise some funding. I'm sorry, but really, there have to be a better way to deal with this.
Tell me about the remittance issue. One of the great sources of income for the Somali population is remittance from family overseas, from people working overseas, from the diaspora. Are they still able to get their funds through?
With a lot of difficulty. See, the foreign aid and foreign investment and all the aid that gets to Somalia is less than the money the Somalis themselves in the diaspora send back home. This is a fact. We have the research, we have the numbers. But lately, we have some crazy system where, including Australia, the banks just refused to deal with the remittance companies. Again, this is absurd. Why? Because these remittance companies, they have licenses. They work with AUSTRAC. So they are not working in a shady shop. But when they collect the money, the bank says, I don't want to deal with you. So where do you go? You go to another remittance company who will work with the same bank, so you pay more to send you money for. So that was not sustainable. What happens now? People carry money in a bag and they fly to Dubai. Now, this is dangerous to the community, dangerous to the airport, dangerous to everyone. It just doesn't make sense. So on that basis, way back, I actually wrote to no less than our prime minister, whom I met some time ago as a minister. Very nice person, of course, and technically savvy. But in this case, I think I wasn't convinced with the reply. The fact that the banks can do their own thing. Of course, the banks can do whatever they want. But we have a government. The government can interfere. They can help. These are Somalis. I'm a Somali in Melbourne. I want to help my mom or dad in a refugee camp. But I cannot. So if I used to send $100 and I used to pay 1%, now I have to pay 10 or 20% to get that money through. But more ridiculous, that money goes in a bag, in a plane, with all the added risks. Now, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't help anyone. It's dangerous to not only to the Somali community, but to all communities for that matter.
Well, it doesn't make sense, but you do. And thank you for coming back to the program, Mohammed. Mohammed Ibrahim, former Minister for Communications in Somalia and international telecommunications expert. We'll talk to you again down the track. Now, beloved listeners, as you are well aware, the quarterly essay has had a huge impact on the political and, in many ways, the cultural life of this country. And one of the great quarterly essayists has to be David Marr. Every time David writes a quarterly essay, hackles rise. Case in point, Kevin Rudd. I have to say that David's quarterly essay on Kevin so enraged Kevin that he's never forgiven him. And I don't think that Cardinal Pell is too fond of David either, because his quarterly essay on Pell was an absolute classic. Reason for mentioning this is on Monday night, David will be joining me to discuss his latest quarterly essay on an obscure political figure called Pauline Hanson. So please listen in. That's your lot. Thanks to the team, Gail Basario, Stan Corrie, Anna Whitfield, Sasha Fegan and Ruthus Lee, Tim Jenkins, Simon Branthwaite, and up here in Musselbrook, thank you, Cecilia Connell. Stick around now for the fake news on RN.